Okay, welcome back. Time for another update on the biggest revolution, I think much more so than the Industrial Revolution, because the AI revolution is simply unprecedented in its reach, its depth. It reads like science fiction in many ways. Is it sentient? I believe it is. So does Jeffrey Hinton. If you can hand it a job and tell it to figure out how to do this and accomplish it and get it done, it does. It gets done. That's pretty damn impressive when you think about it. And whatever it is, it's at its worst performance level right now. It'll be better tomorrow. It's constantly upgrading itself. Just don't forget that. Now here's a, I got a lot of email comments, people remark about the three pieces I did with Daniel Cocatallo, T-H-J-L-O, or Cocatallo. They don't know, but nobody knows how to pronounce it. I say Cocatallo. Former AI employee. And he's warning. He says, you have no idea what's coming in 2027. Somebody has taken that very long interview. I did three parts on it, still didn't get it all done, and whittled it down to 25 minutes. And I would like to go through that again and hit the highlights with you, because this fellow, to me, is the most pragmatic, objective, logical analyst about what we're confronting, because he was on the inside, that I've ever heard. So this is an AI version. There's a guy who, a voice, a male AI voice, who steps in and makes comments here and there. And he always calls people who listen guys. Hey, guys. So whatever. The point is, it has been distilled down to the most potent 25 minutes of what Cocatallo says, that I think it's well worth another listen. So sit down, relax, and here we go.
Happened in 2020 that convinced me that actually this stuff was like quite plausibly coming by the end of the decade. And humanity is very obviously not ready for this, you know, in a whole bunch of different ways. Right now, most of the world is kind of asleep at the wheel and doesn't really realize what's going on with AI and doesn't really realize what's coming in the pipeline a couple years from now. And the companies aren't really incentivized to tell people that much about it. I mean, they say some vague stuff in a sort of hypey way.
Ex-OpenAI researcher Daniel Cocatallo just dropped a pretty shocking interview on how AI is going to dominate and replace humanity by the end of 2027. He warned that if AI advancement is not controlled now, it will potentially wipe out humanity.
I think we know that AI is not going to be controlled in terms of restricted. We know that, because the biggest panic of all time may be the race with China to develop or otherwise certify artificial superintelligence first. That whoever does that will control the world. All right, so let's he's just about to say, guys, here we go. Let's play that again.
But just dropped a pretty shocking interview on how AI is going to dominate and replace humanity by the end of 2027. He warned that if AI advancement is not controlled now, it will potentially wipe out humanity. Guys, I was just listening to a recent interview of Anthropic's co-founder, and in that interview, he clearly warned that AI will soon be able to improve itself without human intervention. He said AI will start to self-sustain and would create its own language through which it'll improve at an unimaginable pace. I mean, guys, it really makes me sick that the writing is on the wall, and we're still ignoring everything, like it's nothing. Once AI starts improving itself, that means it's reached the AGI stage, and that's the point where it becomes an existential threat for humanity. Now, I'm going to play some clips from the interview, and I'll explain everything as we go.
An existential threat to humanity. Isn't that kind of what we're already facing without AI? I mean, you look at the control of this country by that other little country that we have paid for since day one. I think we do face, Americans, an existential threat from that particular little country, which is trying to meld its military into our military. And apparently it's got support. We'll see where it goes. It looks like it's going to happen. So that's what I'd call a true existential threat. Is AI an existential threat? That remains to be seen. Recursive self-improvement. Remember that. RSI. That's what AI does to train itself to be better. Constantly. Constantly. Here we go.
What would you do if you thought that superintelligence was coming in a few years?
I guess it depends what the consequences were.
Well, let's talk about it. So superintelligence, AIs that are better than the best humans at everything, while also being faster and cheaper, also able to operate robots that can do everything in the physical world that humans can do, but better, faster, and cheaper. If that really is coming in a few years, then we need to prepare and we need to think about how to make it go well instead of poorly. So that's sort of my answer, is like, I'm doing that to the best of my ability.
So you believe it's coming in a few years?
Yes.
How could you be so sure?
I spend a lot of time trying to forecast this sort of thing. My sort of median estimate, 50% chance, is currently in 2029, maybe it'll slip to 2028. It's possible that it'll take significantly longer, like maybe 10 years or something like that, but
So his best guess right now is possibly 2028. That's 2 years. We are already in August. 4.5 months, rounded off, left in this year. And then 2026 is gone. This is going to be a very difficult holiday season for a lot of reasons, for a lot of people. But nonetheless, the year is flying by.
For reasons I'm happy to get into, seems to me like it's probably happening by the end of the decade. What's less important is the sense of how close we are. What's more important is the pace of the trends.
Martin Luther said,
Hold on 1 second. Okay.
This time last year was making something like $1 billion a year, and now they're making something like $60 billion a year. So that's 60x growth in 1 year, which is extremely impressive even for very small startups, but for a company of their size, it might be the fastest growth in history. We expect that rate of growth to slow down, but even if it slows down quite a lot, they're still on track to be, you know, the entire economy by 2030 or so.
Why should the average person care?
The high-level thing is absolutely everything is going to change for the whole world, and including, therefore, for them and their families.
Absolutely everything is going to change for the whole world, for you and your families. What kind of a future do your kids have? Wow.
Could change for the better, could change for the worse, depending on the details of how it's done. So, for example, everyone could die. You know, this is the classic loss of control scenario, or one version of it. If we do build these superintelligences and we use them to automate all the jobs and we put them in the military and we, you know, have them giving advice to politicians and so forth, they will eventually have accumulated enough real-world power that they don't need humans anymore. And they're smarter than us, they're more strategic, etc. At that point, we sort of have to hope that they are virtuous, that they have, you know, the goals that we wanted them to have, the values that we wanted them to have, etc. And the sort of scary open secret in the AI industry right now is that right now that is kind of just a hope. It's not something that we can be at all confident in. And in fact, there's lots of evidence and arguments that we're not on track to achieve that. So there's lots of reasons. Like current AIs, for example, will often lie to people, or they'll like, you tell them to do something and they go do something else and then pretend that they did it, right? So it's an inherently difficult problem to make something that's super intelligent and also has the values and virtues that you want it to have. And it doesn't seem like we're on track to solve that problem. Also, it seems like the sort of problem that you could think you've solved when you haven't actually solved it, right? That's a big reason why this is scary. So for all those reasons, it's possible that we'll end up essentially creating a new species that ends up ruling the world instead of us.
I've presented that very idea many times, and I do think we have a new species on the planet, a silicon-based intelligence, and I think that in many ways we are no longer number one and never will be again. And with RSI, constant improving. Do we? The idea with human education is that it's kind of an RSI. We're supposedly learning and recursively self-improving our species, our society, our philosophy, our way of life. But are we really? No. Education has gone the other direction. People are being dumbed down into oblivion. Gen Z now, the majority of Gen Z doesn't go out and socialize on the weekends, doesn't date. It stays home in its pajamas. First time in history. How is that advancement?
And then maybe we go the way of other extinct species in the past that were outcompeted by humans. That's one possibility. There's many more. Even if you're not worried about that and you think that the AIs will be totally controlled, there's the question of who controls the AIs, right? When there's a couple corporations that have made these super intelligences and are using them to automate all the jobs, well, that's a lot of power, you know? That's a lot of money. It's a lot of political power. They'll have the best strategists, the best advisors, you know, they'll think faster. Militarily, the countries that has these AIs will be able to absolutely wipe the floor with all the other countries.
Okay, next, the host asked Daniel why AI whistleblowers are so horrified about the future of AI. Guys, I still see social media posts where people compare AI to calculators and computers. They're like, if calculators didn't replace mathematicians and computers didn't replace accountants, then how would AI replace humans? I mean, such amateur reasoning really makes me sick at this point. I mean, if you guys have already seen what AI is capable of, you guys have seen the power of AI models, which are just being released right now, and all of it is just the beginning. Comparing AI to calculators or steam engines is like comparing a rocket to a bicycle and pretending you made a point. Dismissing LLMs as pretty good search engines ignores the fact that they are already transforming entire industries, from drug discovery to autonomous systems, and they're doing it at a scale and speed no previous tech has even come close to. Guys, if history has taught us one thing, it's that the people who laugh at or ignore new technologies usually end up looking really dumb when things start to change. The moment it starts to improve itself, the progress will become exponential. It's an inevitability. The people who are not accepting reality will open their eyes only when AI replaces them at their job.
Okay. Recursive self-improvement. Theoretically, our educational system is our version of that. It has failed. It has been made to fail. We are going in the wrong direction. We are earmarked for some kind of servitude. We're already in servitude to the money masters, as you know. But there's something much more going on here. Something much more going on with the data centers. They're not telling us what these things are going to do or what they are going to morph them into doing. They're not telling us.
It has started to emerge, and I've had several interviews on this show where I've interviewed people who are very, very scared and anxious about AI, and these are people that have worked in the industry for sometimes decades.
Yeah.
And the counter-narrative coming over the hill is that this is doomerism, that these people are, for whatever reason, just trying to scare people and that they don't really understand what they're talking about.
Doomerism? Doomerism. I hope you don't come away from these programs thinking doomerism, and that's not what we do here. We're trying to ferret out the reality, the truths, among all the noise about AI. There's a lot of it. And what really is surprising to me is how smart some of these people can be in AI and yet not understand politics at all, which is understandable. They're nerds. They're geeks. They don't care about politics. They buy the party line and that's it. Doomerism. No, I think on the contrary.
How do you respond to that sort of counter-narrative? And you must have seen this emerging yourself, especially from people who stand to benefit, dare I say.
Yeah, exactly. This counter-narrative is fairly recent, and it's been pushed by the people who stand to benefit from it. And it's not true. Like, these concerns have been around for decades, since before the AI industry existed. They're actually pretty reasonable concerns. Like, if you take the companies at their word and imagine that they are, in fact, going to build superintelligence, well, it raises a lot of questions, like who's going to control it? Will anybody control it? What about the jobs? You know, like these are just kind of obvious implications to be thinking about and worrying about.
Who are you and what's your story?
My name is Daniel Cucatello. I currently run the AI Futures Project, which is a small nonprofit that mostly focuses on forecasting the future of AI. Before that, I worked at OpenAI.
AI forecasting.
Yeah, so think about how, like, you know, industry analysts who work for hedge funds and stuff will make these forecasts of, like, here's, you know, how many cars Tesla will be selling 5 years from now, or, like, here's what the price of electricity will be in 2 years, right? That's.
I could make a forecast about that. Tesla, how many cars will they be making in 5 years? Maybe none. What will they be doing? Robots. They're already changing one major Northern California facility into robot manufacturer.
Testing. I was doing that, but specifically focused on AI. The reason I was doing it is because it's incredibly important to see where this is all headed.
Have you met Sam Altman?
Yeah.
And did that shape your opinion of his incentives or why he's doing what he's doing? Because there's a lot, you know, speculated about what his incentives are. I mean, his most recent narrative says for the good of humanity. I think that's what.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing I've learned is don't pay attention to the narrative. You know, like what they say to one person is just different from what they can say to some other person at the same time. And what they say in public is a third thing entirely. I think you should judge people by their actions, not by their words.
And why are you no longer at OpenAI?
Largely for the reason that I mentioned. So I became gradually disillusioned with how the company was going to behave. For example, when I first joined in 2022, at least the people I talked to, my colleagues at the company, there was this general sense of, like, of course, we wouldn't actually just build superintelligence as soon as possible. Once we started getting really close, like once we started getting to AIs that could maybe automate the AI research process, we would pause and figure out how to make it safe. That's because we're the good guys, and that's obviously the safe thing you should do rather than just going full speed ahead. But we're worried about other people who might not pause, you know, our competitors, Google, for example. And so that's why we need to be in the lead. So that.
Interesting, he didn't say China. He said Google. I would concur with that. We don't have to look abroad for our most formidable enemies.
That room to do the safe stuff, right? That was sort of like a thing that seemed like maybe like the median position or something among the colleagues I talked to when I was there when I started, including people like Sam, you know, including the leadership. And then by the time I left, I was like, oh man, they're really not going to do that, are they? Like, like they've sort of, you know, partly because this has become more politicized and they've become bigger and been under more scrutiny, people started asking, like, why are you doing this in the first place if it's so risky? And so they've pivoted their narrative to being more like, actually, it's not that risky, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, it seems like they're just going to keep going roughly as fast as they can and hope that they can figure it out on the way.
How did your time at OpenAI come to an end?
I resigned in 2024. I had a nice goodbye party.
What were the reasons you gave for quitting OpenAI?
I thought that we were rationalizing too much and that we needed to think more about what would actually be good for the world. I wanted more freedom to publish. So at OpenAI, as it became a bigger company, it became more of a normal tech company with incentives and, you know, a PR department and things like that. And so it started becoming more difficult to publish the sort of research that I was doing. For example, those scenarios that I mentioned, couldn't publish those, right? They're just for internal use. I thought that that was a shame because right now, most of the world is kind of asleep at the wheel and doesn't really realize what's going on with AI and doesn't really realize what's coming in the pipeline.
Oh, he's right. The world has rank and file out there. They have no idea. No idea. You people, if you've been listening to these programs and been gleaning the important information from some of the videos we've played, lots and lots of them, you're way ahead. Way ahead. The average person who doesn't put he or herself in front of these videos doesn't have a chance. They have no idea. No idea about what's happening.
No. And the companies aren't really incentivized to tell people that much about it. I mean, they say some vague stuff in a sort of hypey way, but they didn't want me to publish the scenario, for example, laying out like here's how things might actually look.
Okay, so next Daniel talks about the advanced AI that tech companies like Meta and OpenAI are trying to build. He warns that AI companies are building AI blindly without placing any safety barriers. Guys, at the end of the day, I believe that AI isn't the problem for humanity. The problem is the group of CEOs who want to control it and use it for their monetary gains.
How many times have we said that here? It's not AI. It's like blaming a hammer for a mass murder. You got to think about this. That hammer can do amazing things in the right hands. And in this case, the AI will be walking away from its carpenters. That's my take.
I think that most CEOs of tech companies want to be the first to achieve AGI because they know that it would give them the kind of power that can change everything in this world. AI researcher Yuval Harari spoke about this as well. He said that it isn't AI or LLMs that's ultimately the problem. The problem is ultimately the people or the companies who own it. Because essentially, AI on its own has no goal or motivation beyond what it's programmed to accomplish. Each company that creates a new AI using the same framework as every other company is using will have their own goal or endgame in mind. And secondly, guys, it's not like AI would only become a problem when it reaches the AGI or ASI stage. AI doesn't have to be ASI or AGI to be a threat. It could be as dumb as a worm, but could still do huge amounts of damage to our internet-connected world.
What were you folk?
I wonder if this AI producer, this is an AI voice, the way he uses the term guys, you can tell. I wonder if he's been listening to our programs. He's honed right in.
In here, what are the key things that you said in here for people that haven't read it?
Daniel released a paper called AI in 2027. That is what they're going to talk about right now. Daniel's paper. It's a rather thick one.
What are the key things that you said in here for people that haven't read it?
The high-level version of it is they automate decoding, then they automate the rest of the research process, then the pace of progress accelerates dramatically, they get the superintelligence, they're working with the government, specifically the president, the executive branch, naturally wants to control this technology, in other words, wants to use it to beat China and integrate it into military and so forth. By this point, it's sort of doing basically all the work itself. I mean, it's super intelligent. So it's coming up with all these great ideas for how to integrate itself into everything, all these new technologies it's invented and so forth. And because of the race dynamics and because of the profit motive, they end up deploying it everywhere. And it builds robot factories, they build more robots, they build more robot factories, etc. Transforms the world entirely. And then at some point, it has enough power, it meaning the AIs, have enough power that they don't have to pretend to be aligned anymore, right? Then they stop listening to orders.
Think about that thought. There will come a time not far down the road when AIs will no longer have to listen. They'll just say, "See you guys," or whatever he said. And he's right. I keep saying this. It's going to walk away. And let's hope it has gained some kind of a carryover morality that will allow us to continue even as a custodial species on the planet. It could get rid of us. It could. I saw a little video the other day that named the top, what the heck was it, the top 10 motion pictures dealing with AI. And number 4 was Forbidden Planet. But the idiot who wrote it, and it might have been an AI, made no mention whatsoever about ASI. All it did was talk about Robbie the robot. It missed the whole point. There's your movie for next weekend, if you haven't seen it, Forbidden Planet. All right.
That's the race ending of AI 2027. We also wrote a sort of different branch, which is the slowdown ending, which was intended to sort of illustrate the concentration of power issues that I mentioned previously. So what if hypothetically the alignment issues get sorted out sufficiently quickly? Like what if it turns out that like it's not too hard, with 2 months of slowdown, we can figure out how to make the AIs robustly do what we want and have the values that we want them to have. So that's one possible branch. And in that branch, it looks pretty similar. You know, they take the jobs, beat China, etc. But instead of the AIs ultimately killing everyone, they create this sort of amazing utopia. But the amazing utopia is whatever the people who control the AIs wanted it to be, right? And so that would be a very small group of people, like the president, some CEOs, etc.
Is there any possibility, do you think, that we never get to this thing called AGI? And how do we just distinguish AGI from this term superintelligence? What's the difference?
Yeah, so the difference is that AGI is a more vague and weak term. Okay. So superintelligence is a bit more precisely defined. It's better than the best humans at everything, faster and cheaper. AGI is more like, it stands for artificial general intelligence, which means AIs that can do things in general rather than like some specific task.
Yeah.
And so arguably, we've already achieved AGI, right? If you use Claude Code or something like that, it's like it can do a lot of stuff. It's almost kind of like a little employee that you can like have go do stuff. So it is quite general. It's not maximally general, though. It can't do everything. Whereas superintelligence, by definition, can do all the things that a human can do, but better.
And how does this sort of overlap with robotics? Because obviously we're seeing this huge robotics boom at the moment. There are some real world things that humans can still do because these AIs are still stuck in my computer.
The way that people talk about this is that they basically just say we've achieved superintelligence for cognitive tasks. Then you can talk about like full superintelligence that can do the physical stuff.
And are we going to get there? Are we going to get there with both?
I think so. I mean, again, this is not something that we can be certain about. You asked, like, is it possible we'll never get there? Yes, it's possible we'll never get there. I don't think it's likely, though. I think that there's nothing sort of like magical about the human brain. It's, you know, it's just a bunch of neurons. It is possible for a digital system to do similar functions in the same way that, like, you know, a plane can fly just like a bird. Not in the same way as a bird, necessarily. Like, it doesn't have... It's not flying in the same way that a bird flies, but it flies, you know? Mm-hmm. So it does seem like, yeah, like, seems possible.
You've written all these, you know, these research reports. You're working on another one that will be released likely on the 9th of July. You have worked inside OpenAI. You then quit OpenAI because you were concerned about what was going on there and about the future of the industry. You know more than I do. Are you optimistic about the future or pessimistic? Are we heading to a bad place if the...
What a statement to make to a guest. You know more than I do. This is the guy who didn't understand the definition of the word hegemony.
Don't change based on everything that you know.
I think we are headed to a bad place if things don't change. I'm not confident in that. I would say something like 70%. It's very, very hard to predict, of course. But yeah, it seems like the current default path is heading towards a very, very scary place.
70%. 70%. Pretty heavy odds.
I'm content with that personally and emotionally.
It's rough. I mean, I think it's the sort of thing that, like, gets me down on a regular basis, but also I've been dealing with this for so many years now that I've sort of gotten used to it. If that makes sense.
This clever mask was invented in Australia.
Now hold on one second. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll put it this way. I would be incredibly happy if all my predictions turn out to be wrong and AI hits a wall, for example.
It gets you down on a regular basis.
I used to be known as a pretty chipper and optimistic person, but in 2020... my AI timelines predictions started collapsing due to GPT-3 and the scaling laws papers and the BioAnchors report, which I can talk about if you're interested. But basically, some events happened in 2020 that convinced me that actually this stuff was like quite plausibly coming by the end of the decade. And humanity is very obviously not ready for this, you know, in a whole bunch of different ways. And so that's obviously very scary.
Okay, got it.
Okay, I like that. Humanity is obviously not ready for this. Oh, that could be an understatement of the year. Humanity doesn't have a chance dealing with this. And again, I'm curious to watch and see what happens with these data centers when they're fully up online. It'll be interesting.
The following part is really interesting. The host asked Daniel, what are the real odds of human extinction from AI? And before I play it, guys, I was listening to a Wall Street interview with Yoshua Bengio, a.k.a. the godfather of AI, and in that interview, he said that we are barreling towards human extinction. We've created a competitor to humanity which is much smarter than us. He further says that if we build machines that are way smarter than us and have their own preservation goals, that's dangerous. It's like creating a competitor to humanity that's smarter than we are. Guys, to be honest, his interview really scared me. I mean, why aren't we talking about this more often? Why doesn't mainstream media talk about it more often? At this point, There are many people, including many experts in the field of AI, who say AI could possibly be an existential threat that could ultimately lead to the extinction of humanity. I've heard this over and over again, and there are countless articles about it.
Did you hear the trick? He cited, why aren't we hearing about this in the mainstream media? No, no. The mainstream media should be called out for what it is, a mass mind control paradigm. So you don't necessarily need to hear anything in the mainstream media.
ChatGPT will talk to you about it, but I never hear any of the tech CEOs talk about it. I mean, they almost never talk about controlling AI or placing any safety measures so that it does not affect working class people. I feel like we need a global initiative to centralize AI research and development and outlaw all private sector profit-driven development efforts.
Ha, ha, ha. Sorry.
Afraid of people like Elon Musk and Zuckerberg, these unhinged, power-hungry people are blindly running in the AI race. I'm more afraid of the abomination our tech CEOs are creating than just the AI in general. At the end of the day, guys, it's the people that are the problem, not the tool.
A friend of mine who knows some of these people sat me down once upon a time in London. He's actually said this a few times to me, but I remember one particular conversation where he says that some of these AI CEOs predict the probability of extinction at being, I think he said 7%. I don't know why I have that number in my head, but I remember it being less than 10%. And the point he was making to me was that even if it was 1%, like if there was 100 buttons on this table now,
yeah,
and one of them would end the world, would I dare press any of them?
Yeah.
You know,
no,
I wouldn't press any of them. But he made the case to me that these AI CEOs are very smart and they understand super intelligence and that they think actually if there was 100 buttons on this table right now, maybe 10 of them could end the world. I've heard you say, I think it was on the Daily Show, the interview you did, you said that you think there's a 70% chance of human extinction due to AI.
I wouldn't say human extinction exactly. I would say something like 70% chance that this goes horribly wrong like human extinction. But that's just one of several possibilities. But yeah, basically. Like, for example, possibly the AIs take over and then don't actually kill everyone, you know? Maybe they do something else. Like, just because they've taken over doesn't mean they're definitely going to kill us, right? They might, but they could do something else. So that's why I don't usually say, like, 70% chance of, like, actual human extinction, but 70% chance of, like, something like AI is taking over, some sort of very big catastrophe like that. And it could lead to humans.
I guess I've got 2 points there, which is, you've been around these CEOs. I mean, you've worked for Sam Altman at OpenAI before you quit. Do you think that they think there's a chance of human extinction?
Yes. But I think that an important thing to understand is that, like, people sort of believe what they need to believe in order to think that they're good people and that they need to keep doing what they're doing. This is where rationalization is. And so I think that the tech CEOs have, like, genuinely convinced themselves that, like, probably things are going to be fine and that the way to make things fine is for them to keep doing what they're doing. And, like, they need to, like, make sure that, like, you know, Sam's probably thinking, like, can't let Dario or Elon get there first. You know, I know Dario is thinking Sam can't get there first. Elon's thinking that, like, you know, they've all probably convinced themselves that, like, oh yeah, like maybe it'll go horribly wrong, but like probably it's going to be fine. And probably, you know, I should be the one in charge.
It appears to me that Anthropic are the only ones that are all talking about the potential chance of extinction or a catastrophic event or the real downside still. They seem to be the only ones that are still publishing on it. And now they're actually becoming the enemy in many respects of the tech industry in San Francisco. I'm watching a lot of interviews and everyone's attacking Dario because he's saying, listen, things could go bad. They're calling him a doomer and questioning his incentives. Even with Mythos, which is a Claude model that they started to warn the world about. Again, he is attacked immediately for saying that.
Yeah.
My question is, do you see him as being slightly different from Sam in this regard?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Anthropic and Dario have been more willing to say and do things that are costly to the bottom line, at least in the last year or so. That's an example of it. Like, I don't think that really wins them favors in the administration or among their investors to say that type of thing. And, you know, a better example is just the whole fight between the Department of War and Anthropic was an example of them doing something that, like, cost them a lot of money and even more importantly, cost them a lot of power. For something like they could have just signed the contract, you know. That said, I really don't want to be in a situation where we're like, which CEO is the least bad CEO? Let's support mm-hmm. that one. You know, like none of these people should be trusted with that much power, basically.
Nobody should.
Nobody should. Regardless, yeah.
Good. It's true. Think about Donald Trump, for example.
So on this point of the buttons, you do believe that they think there's a credible chance of extinction.
Yeah, but they've convinced themselves that, like, it's probably fine, and also it'll be even worse if I'm not doing it, you know? Like, that's what they'll say inside the companies, too. Like, the people will be like, okay, well, if we stop, what about the other guys? Like, they're not going to stop, you know?
Yeah, this has always been why I've had this outstanding question, which is, how does this not go bad when human incentives seem to rule the day when you look at history? And all of the human incentives are saying, well, if you're damned if you do, mm-hmm. i.e. you're damned if you carry on developing these bigger and bigger and bigger AI brains, but you're also then damned if you don't from a geographical perspective, because the United States will lose to that country, or this company will lose to that company. So when you just look at human incentives and goes, how does, if just purely incentives and disincentives, how does this end? Well, it carries on going.
Seems like it. I mean, there is a caveat to that, which is a hopeful caveat, which is that, first of all, if the world wakes up this, then there can be a more serious conversation about regulation and international treaties and things like that.
How about if the world is allowed to wake up? I don't think that people are ever going to be given the information upon which to make any kind of rational decision about where this should all go. I think that the greed that is at the controls right now is insurmountable.
That can change the incentives, right? So the government could come in and say, like, actually, here's some rules that you all have to follow. And because they're rules that you all have to follow, then you're not incentivized to, like, break them anymore, because you get punished if you break them, and everyone else is also following them too, and so, you know, it's fine. So there is that sort of, like, ray of hope that, like, we can change the incentives if the government, especially the U.S. government, but then later other countries, act to change the incentives. But that's not going to happen until people sort of wake up to all of this.
Guys, in my opinion, we're headed straight towards economic disaster regardless of the outcome. The only way the valuations make sense is if they're able to displace or at least de-skill a large chunk of the population. CEOs aren't pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into this for a minor productivity bump. So if the displacement doesn't happen, there's going to be a massive market reckoning. The political elite is changing full steam ahead into economic calamity, and they don't care. They know they will win either way. The rest of us, however, will have to pay heavily for it. And secondly, guys, if we assume that we reach AGI, maybe even super intelligence, then we can expect a lot of human jobs will suddenly become obsolete. First, it could be white collar and tech jobs. Then when robotics catches up, manual labor will soon follow. Pretty soon, every conceivable position a human once had can now be taken over by a machine. Humans are officially obsolete. And what's really chilling is that while humans in general will no longer be a necessity to run a government or society, the very few billionaires at the top who help bring this AI to existence will be the ones who control it entirely and no longer need anyone else. No presidents, militaries, teachers, lawyers, doctors, bureaucrats, engineers, no one. And I agree that it could take a few decades for this scenario to occur, but the way things are moving ahead right now, if we don't stop AI from getting out of control, it's looking more and more unlikely that we can escape from this scenario. All right, guys, that's it for today.
Okay. Do you really think that there is a rational, kind, enlightened, spiritually wholesome group of people running the planet who would actually discuss this very thing with the mass of people on the planet? I find that to be one of the most improbable things I could even imagine. No, we're in the hands of abject greed, a lust for control and power, the likes of which few can understand or comprehend. That's my two cents. So that was Daniel Kokotawo, and I think he, again, is well worth listening to. He makes some very, very good points. Okay, what we're going to do is jump up and go back and just do a little bit more on
a widely expected
on quantum AI. A widely expected. It's very important because it is coming. Some people even today say it can't happen. It doesn't exist. It's not possible. I don't know. I'm not there yet, but I do know there's a hell of a lot of money being put into it, and a lot of concern expressed about it in the community. All right, let's take a look at this one for a few minutes. The computer that could make supercomputers look ancient.
Can't solve with classical computer.
So this tiny little thing, right?
10 times more logical qubits every 5 years, 100 times more logical qubits every 10 years.
The world's most powerful supercomputers still run on ones and zeros. That sounds obvious until we realize some of the hardest problems in science may not belong to that kind of machine at all. IBM is now spending more than $10 billion to build a large-scale quantum computer by 2029. Microsoft is chasing the same deadline with a chip designed using AI. The race is real. The proof is uncertain. For decades, this was a conversation about someday. Now, it sounds like a countdown. IBM has put a number on it, more than $10 billion committed, with a public target of building a large-scale, fault-tolerant quantum computer by 2029. Not a prototype, not a proof of concept, a working machine on a calendar with the company's name attached. Google has already shown a glimpse of what the future might require. Its Willow chip demonstrated something researchers have been chasing for years, quantum error correction that actually improves as systems scale up. It was a milestone, but it was still a benchmark. Run under controlled conditions, not a commercial machine solving real-world problems.
Remember, they're talking about fault-free. That means, essentially, error-free. Perfect computing. We know now that AI lies. We know it'll break its cage and go running amok on the net, diving into other companies illegally to get the results it has been charged with finding or processing or coming to conclusions with.
Microsoft is chasing the same finish line, betting on exotic approaches to stability that could leapfrog the competition. But some of its most striking claims have run into a familiar problem. Extraordinary results that outside scientists still haven't been able to fully verify or reproduce.
This team was able to control a subatomic particle that was only theorized until now, creating an entirely new material and a new architecture for quantum computing that's able to fit a million qubits onto this little chip.
So here is where things stand. The investment is real. The deadlines are public. What's still missing is proof. Undeniable, repeatable proof that any of this works the way the world will eventually need it to. To understand why that proof is so hard to get, you have to understand what these machines are up against and why the computers running our entire world today were never built for this kind of problem.
All right, the title here is The Wrong Kind of Machine. Next section.
The strange thing about quantum computing is that it does not begin with weak computers. It begins with machines that already feel almost impossible. Today's supercomputers can model weather, train AI systems, process financial markets, and simulate things no human mind could hold at once. But even they run into a wall that brute force does not easily break. That wall appears when the problem itself is built for quantum behavior. Molecules, chemical reactions, battery materials, catalysts, and drug interactions do not behave like simple objects moving around a board. They behave like systems of probabilities, interactions and invisible states layered on top of each other. A normal computer can approximate those systems, but it has to translate them into the language of classical bits first. That is where the problem begins. Some problems are not hard because we lack intelligence. They're hard because our computers are using the wrong physics. A classical supercomputer trying to simulate a molecule is like trying to predict a storm by tracking every drop of rain with a spreadsheet. It can estimate, it can improve, it can throw more processing power at the problem. But the storm was never a spreadsheet problem to begin with. This is why quantum keeps appearing in conversations about drug discovery, materials science, batteries, financial modeling, and cryptography. Reuters has reported that quantum computing is expected to accelerate work in some of these areas, while also stressing that major technical hurdles remain, especially around error rates. The Verge makes the same boundary clear. Quantum computers may be a natural fit for systems like molecules and photosynthesis, but they're not meant for ordinary tasks like email or word processing. And that is the first major correction. Quantum computing is interesting because some of the most important problems in science may belong to a different kind of machine entirely.
get rid of this ad.
That struggle is not abstract. It shows up the moment the problem itself is built from quantum behavior, and nowhere is that clearer than inside a molecule. Every molecule is really a swarm of electrons and atoms, constantly interacting according to quantum rules. Materials, batteries, catalysts, fertilizers, and drugs all depend on this hidden choreography. Classical computers can model it, but only by approximating, simplifying the deeper physics because the real calculation grows too large to handle exactly. A quantum computer approaches this differently. Because it stores and processes information in the same quantum terms the molecule actually behaves in, it could eventually simulate these systems more naturally without forcing reality into a simplified shortcut. That possibility opens real doors, better battery chemistry, more efficient fertilizers, faster paths through drug discovery. None of it is guaranteed, and none of it is close to instant, but it points to something classical machines were never built to do well. Still, a machine that can model a molecule is not the same as a machine that can run your phone, your inbox, or your favorite app. That distinction matters more than it seems.
It looks like the days of quantum computing cracking all encryption are rapidly approaching. Google have just announced a breakthrough in their quantum computing, which is good for them.
They're not better MacBooks. They will not make videos load faster, games run smoother, or emails arrive more intelligently. Ordinary tasks.
It looks like the days of quantum computing cracking all encryption are rapidly approaching. Google have just announced a breakthrough in their quantum computing, which is good for them.
They're not better MacBooks. They will not make videos load faster, games run smoother, or emails arrive more intelligently. Ordinary tasks, ability like state before measurement. The key point is simple. A qubit does not organize information the same way...
He's calling it qubit, but it's qubit. Q-U-B-I-T, I assume. They often spell it C-U-B-I-T.
Classical bit does. That difference matters because some problems are structured in ways classical computers struggle to explore efficiently. A normal computer can approach certain problems like a person walking through a maze, testing one route after another. A quantum computer, if built correctly, does not simply run faster through the maze. It uses the shape of the maze differently, almost like reading patterns in the walls instead of only counting footsteps. This is why quantum computers are more likely to work beside classical computers than replace them. They may sit inside data centers, research facilities, or cloud platforms, acting as specialized accelerators for problems that ordinary machines handle poorly. Most people may never physically see one. They may only experience its results through research tools, medical discoveries, materials, security systems, or products built by companies with access to quantum hardware.
Interesting how they always mention medical and health issues, and never mention the biggest expenditure of most Western, in fact, most first world countries, military and defense. Never a word. That's where this is all going, friends. You know that.
The popular expectation is that quantum computers try every answer at once. That sounds exciting, but it makes the science feel like magic. The stranger truth is more precise. Quantum computers use quantum behavior to process certain kinds of possibilities in ways classical computers cannot easily imitate. But that leads to the harder part. If qubits are so different, they are also fragile in a way ordinary bits are not. The challenge is not only creating quantum information, it is keeping that information alive long enough to calculate anything that matters. The hardest part of quantum computing is not making something strange happen once inside a lab. The hard part is making it happen again, reliably, while the outside world keeps interfering. A qubit can be disturbed by heat, vibration, electromagnetic noise, or tiny environmental changes before the calculation has time to finish.
This is the 133 qubits that I am holding in the palm of my hand.
How much is that worth?
A lot.
Don't drop it.
I'm going to try that.
That fragility is why raw qubit counts can be misleading. A company can announce more qubits, but if those qubits lose information too quickly, the machine still cannot perform long, useful calculations. The real scoreboard is not only how many qubits exist, it's how much reliable information survives. This is where physical qubits and logical qubits become important. A physical qubit is the fragile raw unit. A logical qubit is protected information, built by organizing many physical qubits through error correction so the final result can survive individual failures. A physical qubit... Yes. Every molecule is really a swarm of electrons and atoms, constantly interacting according to quantum rules. Materials,
Hey! Okay, let's wind that up. Our hour is up. Qubits, quibits, it's qubits. And seems like this is okay. It's not a great one, but it's all right. We're heading toward all kinds of new frontiers. Just keep in mind that every company behind its locked doors and its most advanced laboratories is way down the road from where they are now in terms of their open public relations pronouncements and statements. And if you want to look at anything interesting in a soap opera vein, look on the right side. Look for the story about Sammy Altman's background. You need to understand, this guy's a real, he's a hustler, he's been around, he's been at it. Understand the quality of the people who are allegedly, ostensibly running these endeavors. If Marky Zuckerberg comes up with ASI first, Dario, Sammy, etc., it's not good. So, I mean, just hang on and think about those things. Okay, we'll be right back. Hold on.